Chapter 11, 1900. Raul and Naiwa, Sarah's daughter, had been keeping company for about 6 months and decided to marry. They divulged their intentions to Sarah to see what her reaction would be. She was concerned that they didn't know each other long enough, and Chatan and Wachui still hadn't become acclimated to their new surroundings. However, the main problem, from Sarah's perspective, was that Naiwa was a very immature adult. She tried, but she just couldn't assimilate into a predominantly white society or accept her responsibility as a single parent. She basically withdrew into herself and was only comfortable around the family. It was as though she sensed a threat from everyone who wasn't a family member. The children were slowly adjusting to their new world, but Naiwa couldn't comprehend what they wanted and what they were experiencing. When there was a problem at school, it was Sarah who acted as the parent. This wasn't lost on Chatan and Wachui. But after watching the two together and recognizing that Raul was a mature adult, Sarah finally gave her approval and told Tommy. He shared her concerns, but knew that the couple liked each other and it would be a good match. They planned to marry in April. Tommy suggested they build a small frame home on the ranch for the couple, but another option appeared feasible. Sarah and Tommy had purchased the 500-acre Singleton Ranch 5 years earlier after Singleton and his friends were convicted of bank robbery. They didn't tell Naiwa and Raul what they had in mind. This would be a surprise on their wedding day. The Santa Barbara Register moved the ghost shirt murders to the back page and was concentrating on a land speculation scam in the south part of the county. The four children went back to school, and although there were comments made about Tommy and the ghost shirt murders, no one made any attempt to harm them. Like all kids, they took most of what was going on in stride and went about being kids. Tommy talked to Fred Grimes' father and was promised that there wouldn't be any more incidents. It was the first week in February when Jefferson came up to the ranch. He planned to stay for a few days. He'd been contacted by the sheriff to do some follow-up on Tommy's suggestion and interview Spencer and Whitman. They wanted to see if either or both knew anything about the two murders, or if they knew anything that would help in the murder investigation. The assumption was that if there was anything in the past of the two now deceased, the remaining two would know. Jefferson spent an afternoon interviewing Hiram Whitman after Tommy told him about the significance of the dates of the two hangings. "I took an immediate dislike to the man. It wasn't just how he said the only thing that the four had in common was the army, it was his attitude. He seemed to sneer at everything. I wanted to punch him in the mouth. I'm supposed to be a skilled investigator, but I lost my cool." The most relevant thing he had to say was about the skirmishes they had with the Sioux, one of which was at the Battle of Wounded Knee. Whitman said they just did what they were told, nothing spectacular. I asked him if they were part of the 20 soldiers who received the Congressional Medals of Honor for their exploits at Wounded Knee. Whitman shook his head and said the four of them had only minor parts in the action. I asked if he killed anyone. He reluctantly said he might have. He said they were young and everything happened so fast. Their officers were screaming at the soldiers to fire, and the men around him were afraid they'd be shot by the Indians, even though they didn't have any weapons. The only thing he knew for sure was that a lot of Indians were killed that day, and reluctantly, he might have killed one or two. To my question about being at any of the reservations, he stated that he'd been at Pine Ridge. He was part of the detail that acted as an honor guard for the Medal of Honor recipients. He never visited the Standing Rock Reservation. All four men were friendly with each other. When they first arrived, they spent all their time together at your ranch. Later, after they left your employ, they spent most of the time trying to earn a living and socialized infrequently. He and Spencer were looking forward to Butler's wedding. He was happy for Butler, who asked him to be his best man. It was his suggestion that the four come to the valley after their enlistment was up. He'd been in contact with Earl Singleton, his cousin, and the four had been offered jobs on the Star Ranch. They were shocked when they arrived and found out that Singleton was in jail. Reluctantly, he admitted you did a fine thing by giving them jobs. I know you and Singleton had a major run-in, and he went to jail. But I didn't know that you and Sarah bought the Singleton Ranch. It seems as though Singleton had a lot of cousins. Jason Brown, an old friend of yours, was a cousin of his. Maybe they're all from a bad seed. Jefferson knew too well what Sanchez was talking about. He'd been hired to track down Brown, who had robbed a bank in New Mexico and fled to the Santa Ynez Valley. Along the way, he murdered a lawman and 8 bandits before hiding out at Singleton's place. Brown took a fancy to Sarah Sanchez and abducted her. Tommy followed them into the hills, and he and Sarah came out alive. Brown was found a week later by a couple of Chumash hunters. He was dead from a gunshot wound to the head. No one admitted to the killing, and the sheriff decided to let it be. Neither Tommy nor Sarah ever mentioned the incident, and Jefferson didn't ask. When do you meet with Spencer? Later today. What do you think of him? He seemed like the leader of the four, at least while he was here. Perhaps it was because he was a few years older, or it could be for another reason. He got religion a few years back and has a small congregation. I was only friendly with Butler, though I liked Spencer and Higgins. I fired Whitman. Tommy, I'm not sure about Whitman. He could be our man, but there's nothing in my interview that would lead me to him. Why don't we talk after I meet with Spencer? Raul had a few errands to run in Santa Ynez. He rode his favorite horse, Sammy, into town and stopped at the post office to mail a package to his mother in Guadalajara, Mexico. His father had passed away 10 years ago, and Raul sent money every month to his mother and sister, who lived together. He wanted to bring them here, but he hadn't been able to put aside enough money. Hopefully, he'd be able to accomplish that goal in the future. Perhaps the patron would raise his salary. As he walked inside the mail room, he glanced up at the beam where the barber had been hanged. Sammy was pawing at the ground when Raul came back out. On closer inspection, Raul noticed that the horse's right front shoe was loose. So, he decided to lead the horse to Whitman's livery stable and have him replace the shoe. The barn door to the livery stable was locked, so Raul walked around to the rear of the building and tried a small door, but it was padlocked on the outside. Something didn't seem right, because Whitman kept the livery open day and night. In fact, Whitman lived in a converted stall. He walked around to the far side and looked in one of the lower windows. It was covered with dust, so he took a rag out of his saddlebag and wiped one of the panes. He looked inside once, stepped back, and then looked inside again. Whitman was hanging from the main beam in the center of the barn. Raul ran up the street and found Charles Little sitting in his office. In broken English, Raul explained what had happened. They walked back to the livery, and the two of them broke the lock on the rear door and went inside. Little untied the rope holding Whitman, and he and Raul eased the dead body to the floor. The first thing each noticed was the ghost shirt. I want you to get Tommy Sanchez and have him look at this. We'll keep the barn locked until he gets here, Little said. My horse has thrown a shoe. It'll take about 10 minutes to fix it, and then I'll go. Raul borrowed some of Whitman's tools and reshod Sammy's front hoof. He felt uncomfortable working next to a dead body, so he hurried, and then rode to Altura Prado. Sarah greeted Raul after he knocked on the front door. She could tell he was agitated and immediately took him to Tommy, who was working in his office at the rear of their home. Raul's English was still poor, in spite of the lessons from Naomi and Sarah, so he conversed with Tommy in Spanish. Tommy didn't seem surprised by the news. He went into the kitchen and told Sarah what had happened. I'm going to find Jefferson. He went to interview Spencer and is probably still at the church. Raul's concerned that it was he who found the last 2 bodies. Are you taking Raul with you? No, I'll leave him here. I've never seen him this worried. He found Jefferson inside Spencer's church. The interview appeared to be over. The two men were talking about fishing when Tommy entered the church. Tommy took Jefferson aside and told him what Raul had reported. The two rode to Whitman's barn and banged on the rear door of the livery. Little opened the door and the two rode inside the barn. Tommy looked around the barn and asked the constable to open the front door so they could have more light. Their investigation took 30 minutes. The three sat down on some bales of hay piled on the side of the barn. "Charles, this doesn't look good." Whitman was hanged nearly the same way as Higgins and Butler. The ghost shirt is nearly identical to the ones found on the other dead men. The boot marks on the floor around the body are the same, and the type of rope is similar. Then there's his face that's painted red like the other two, and the lock of his hair in a cup at his feet. It's either a Sioux ritual, or someone who knows about our history is leading us in that direction, Tommy said. Whitman was one of four soldiers who came to the valley at the same time. Each worked for me for 6 months before they went their own way. Three of them are dead. Spencer is the only one left living. Jefferson talked to Spencer within the past hour and Whitman a few days ago. I'll let him tell you what he found out. The first ghost shirt that Spencer saw wasn't on Higgins. It was at Wounded Knee when one of the Indians who camped there put on the shirt and performed what they thought was the ghost dance. Whitman felt that the shirt on Higgins was similar to the one he saw at the massacre. Not that Spencer would recognize any survivor of the massacre, but he did look around Santa and Nez Valley to see if there was an Indian here that could be a survivor of that action. So, yes, he was aware, more than the others, what might be the root cause of the hangings. He was more forthcoming than Whitman. He said they were standing on one side of a pile of weapons confiscated from the Indians, who were on the other side of the cache. Agitation started between both sides as they stood out there in the cold. The only difference between the two groups was, one side had weapons, the other didn't. When a gun was discharged, all hell broke loose. The problem was that no one knew who fired that shot, and after that, none of the soldiers cared. The soldiers went berserk for a few minutes and fired indiscriminately into the Indian masses. They killed anything that moved. They even shot some who they knew were dead. It didn't matter. Women and children were slaughtered as they ran. All Spencer could say was that it was horrible. Neither Higgins nor Butler felt they were targeted, or at least they didn't raise the issue to Spencer. When the first two were hanged, Whitman asked Spencer if he hanged the two. "Do you think these are revenge killings?" Little asked. "Yes, but I don't know what the revenge is about. My best guess is that one of the survivors of Wounded Knee or some other battle is committing these acts." Whitman even wondered if Tommy was behind the hangings, Jefferson said. Tommy smiled. "We know that the three who were hanged, plus Spencer, were in the valley for the past 4 years. There are a few young men who have come here during that time, but none appear to be of Indian ethnicity. The other thing that puzzles me is, how did this person or person find the three men who were hanged? It seems unlikely that someone came here and saw the four in the valley and recognized them from the massacre. I believe that he knew they were here, and he knew what they looked like. If the cause is Wounded Knee, then our killer was there, and either remembered the four, or he tracked them down before they left the army. We need to ask Spencer if any civilian made friends with them while they were in the army, probably close to their discharge date, Jefferson said. Where do we go from here? Little asked. I think Spencer has to be cautious. Perhaps a bodyguard or a sheriff's deputy as his companion would be appropriate until this is settled. Why don't you contact the sheriff and share our concerns? Tommy said, I don't think there's any more we can do here today, Charles. I assume that Dr. Cunnan will find the same results after he performs an autopsy on the body. Let me know what he finds. I've been retained by the sheriff as a consultant for these murders. You can always contact me at Mr. Sanchez's ranch. If you're ready, Tommy, let's head back to the ranch, Jefferson said. No, I'd like to talk to Spencer before we head back. They found Spencer in his church, sweeping the floor. He seemed surprised, because Jefferson and Sanchez had left him about an hour ago. Did you forget something? Jefferson spoke first. Whitman was found hanged in his livery. We just came from there. Spencer staggered and the broom fell from his grasp. He then sat down on one of the pews in the hall. Tommy and Jefferson pulled up chairs and sat across from him. You don't think I did these killings, do you? I think we're way past that now. The body was warm, So my guess is that you didn't do it. I'd like you to think about Wounded Knee and whether anyone made contact with you and the other four while you were at Fort Robinson or on your trip to California, Tommy asked. The only Indians that I saw were at Pine Ridge Reservation when I was part of the Honor Guard for the Medal of Honor recipients. I don't remember seeing any at the fort or on our trip here. What about a young man who was white or a light-skinned Mexican? None that I can recall. Wait a minute. There was a young white man with long hair who took a picture with us after the medal ceremony at Pine Ridge. We took several pictures and sent one to him in Sydney. He said he worked for the railroad. Come to think of it, I saw him at Fort Robinson once, and then in Sydney before we boarded the train west. He said he was on railroad business. Do you think a former soldier is hanging my friends? I don't think he's an ex-soldier. I think he's an ex-Sioux Brave, who is white and hanged the other three. Do you have a copy of the photo? I don't, but Butler was the one who took the photos. I don't know if he saved a copy. That's a long time ago. Would you be able to recognize that young man if you saw him in the valley? Perhaps. I want you to think hard. Is it possible that there's someone in the valley you've seen that could be that young man? Come to think of it, I remember someone that seemed familiar to me at the time, but I couldn't remember where I'd seen him before. Where did you see him? I don't remember. Let me think about it and see if I can recall. We're going to ask the sheriff to assign a deputy to you. We think you're in danger. I'd appreciate it. They rode down Sagunta and Robla streets before they turned onto the road toward Los Olivos. Altura Prado was 2 miles west of them. Other than Juan and myself, there are only 2 Sioux in this valley. If Spencer didn't hang the other three, could it be one of the Chumash, or even an ex-soldier who had a vendetta against the 4 soldiers? Jefferson asked. Everything points to an Indian. I don't think any soldier knows all the rituals that the Sioux use, and that goes for the Chumash too. The paint on the face and the lock of hair in a cup were things we did for our dead. There are, however, certain factions of our tribe that are fair-skinned. Maybe our culprit is such a person, Tommy responded. You feel pretty certain about that a Sioux did this, don't you? Yes. They were about a mile from the ranch when a shot rang out, and Tommy fell to the ground on the side of the road. Jefferson jumped off his horse and unholstered his gun. But he didn't see anyone. His first thought was of Tommy, who lay on his side. Jefferson rolled him over and saw blood coming from his left shoulder. Tommy was conscious and started to rise. Hold on a second. Let me look around before you get up. That shot had to come from the field north of U.S., but I don't see any movement. Tommy rose and grabbed hold of the reins of his horse. Let's assume that the shot came from the north. We'll walk and keep our horses to our right until we get to that grove of trees about 200 yards up the road, Tommy said as he started walking. When they reached the grove of trees, Tommy sat down and leaned against one of the sycamores, and Jefferson tore open his shirt, exposing the wound. It looked like the bullet entered about 3 inches below the top of his shoulder and probably exited through his chest muscle, just missing the heart. Someone tried to kill you just now. You were lucky. I assume they used a rifle and were behind some boulders because I couldn't see anyone. I think I can ride. I don't think it's wise to go back to the doctor in Santa Ynez. Naomi has treated gunshot wounds before, and so has Sarah. I'll feel better at home. John Smart followed the two from Spencer's church. He knew that Sanchez was no fool and would gradually put it all together. He thought of leaving town, but that would definitely point to his guilt. He'd have to take care of Sanchez. It was easy to slip out of town, parallel the main road, and hide behind the boulders that covered the landscape. When he saw Sanchez and the Pinkerton man, he took his time, aimed and fired. He knew he hit him and saw him fall off his horse, but he wasn't sure it was lethal. He waited a few minutes. And when he saw the riders rise and walk toward the grove of trees, he tried to get another shot at the former Sioux Brave. When he realized that he couldn't get a clear shot, he decided to head back to town. He He was lucky no one came to investigate the shot, nor did anyone see him come back and go to his room. When they rode up to the ranch house, Sarah came out to greet them. She had a wide smile on her face as she moved to greet Tommy. That's when she saw the blood, and she stopped and put her hand to her mouth. "Oh my God, Tommy, who did this to you?" "We don't know. Call Naomi. Have her probe to make sure the bullet isn't still in there." Jefferson and Sarah helped Tommy off his horse just as Raul ran up to the two riders. "Who did this, patron?" Jefferson spoke to Raul. "We were ambushed about a mile from here. Why don't you take a couple of men and see what you can find?" He was hit about 200 yards east of the grove of trees on the main road. "I suspect that whoever did this was behind some rocks, maybe 100 yards north of the road. Actually, it was between the town and the road." Raul's English was poor, so Sarah translated in Spanish. Soon, Raul and two of his vaqueros rode off toward town. They gave Tommy a large glass of whiskey, and when he finished, Naomi went to work, with Sarah assisting. They confirmed that the bullet had passed through his body. After they cleaned and bandaged the wound, Naomi said, "It's going to be sore for a few weeks, but it doesn't look like there's a lot of damage to the muscles. Tommy must be making someone nervous. This was an actual attempt on his life." "I'm going to notify the sheriff," Jefferson told them. "No, let's keep this between ourselves. I don't want to give whoever shot me the satisfaction of thinking that he was successful. I also don't want to give that damned editor more ammunition to go after us. Maybe the one who hanged Whitman and the others is getting nervous and wants you out of the way," Sarah said. "You may be right. I'll have to be more careful,"